if you guys have questions on it.
I
Okay. Sivo's already gone. That's going too, but we're not broadcasting it. Because I wanted to keep the Sivo on another computer to save resources.
Thank you. When I get it, everything you pile on. Justin, are you about ready?
Religious about which one of these is better. And it's the same in this sort of, some people think, like, oh, neural networks are so much better than decision trees. And other people, decision trees are much better. In the real world, what you'll find is that really the teacher is more important than the student. So it really doesn't matter which phone you have. What really matters is that you know how to use your phone. And this is true in this situation. So there are various parameters that go into using these different algorithms, and it matters that you understand what those mean, that in a given situation you're getting the most out of your phone, right? So it really doesn't matter which phone is best. And in fact, you can always pit two things against each other, the decision tree neural network, sport vector machine, and usually you find percent level difference. Using each of them properly. So whenever you see people claiming that they're getting big differences, it usually means they're not using one of them properly. So a decision tree, a single decision tree, not a boosted one, is actually quite a simple construct. So you start with some training sample of data where you know which of the data events are signal, which is background. So this is my circle here. All the data that I have, both signal and background, are all sitting in this sample. And so then what I do is I take all this data and I loop over all of the variables I have access to, and I see if I were to split the data into two components on just one variable, where would I split it that maximizes some figure of merit? So this figure of merit might be like signal significance or some combination of purity and efficiency or whatever you're interested in doing. And so then what it does is it loops over all the variables, figures out where it would split, and then it does split using the variable that gives the best separation between signal and background. Right? So you loop over all your variables, you find out, oh, if I split on the variable X at this particular point, I get, you know, mostly background here and signal here. And then simply at each of these nodes, which are referred to as branches eventually, it just repeats the same process. It says, okay, now how do I split this data so that I get the best separation between signal and background? And it just repeats this process over and over again until it stops. When it stops, you have a leaf. And so it stops when it, for example, can't improve the figure of merit. So if it produces a node that's all signal or all background, then of course there's nowhere to go anymore. There's nothing to do. It would also stop if it reaches various parameters, like has a maximum number of leads, or perhaps a minimum number of events in a lead. You might tell it, well, if you only have, say, 10 events, then I don't want you to split anymore, so it's also just overdoing it. But that's really it. That's how a decision tree works. It's quite simple. The problem is what's called overtraining. This is the problem for all machine learning, is that, you know, at some point, if you're looking at the training data, what you want to learn is properties of the parent PDF so that when you see new data that you don't know the answer to, you can properly classify it. What you don't want to learn is just the really fine details of the specific data you have. So you don't want to be like, oh, if I draw a really small box around this data point I have, then that's all signal in that little small box, but I've made an infinitely small box, and so that doesn't mean anything. You know, it's kind of obvious. But if you let the tree just split forever until it had, say, one event each week, that's what it would do. It's a fine way to just put all the events. So what you're trying to avoid is fine-tuning. And so this is really the big game to play, is how do you not overlearn? How do you learn everything you want to learn but not overlearn? And so basically if you overlearn, then you'll hurt your performance on future data. You want to avoid that. So the basic approach is what's known as training and validation. So you have training data, but you also then need to have validation data. So data where you also know the answer, but you didn't use it in the training. So the machine didn't see this data when it was learning, but you do know the answer. And so one of the ways you can know that you're not overlearning is, for example, if you have these two samples, if the performance of the machine on, say, the training sample and validation sample is actually similar, whereas the training sample is clearly the optimally biased sample, this is the sample you actually use to design the selection. So if its performance is similar there to an independent sample that it didn't see during training, then you know it'll just perform basically the same.
What do you mean by performance?
So whatever your figure of merit you're getting is. something like that. If you're looking for, say, some sort of rare decay, you would use signal significance. You can see, oh, I'm getting, you know, this signal efficiency with this amount of background, and it looks similar between the two. Then you know that you're going to be okay on any other data. TMVA produces these plots for you automatically, where it shows you the distribution of response from your classifier, from the training sample and validation sample for both signal and background. So you can see if the shapes look the same. And if they do, then you're okay. If you take significant differences, then you don't really know what's going to happen on other data. And so you can often do various things, although generally you won't run into this problem if you use a modern algorithm from a packet that's well designed. They already prevent this from happening. But you should always check that it's not happening. And so one of the ways you avoid overtraining is called is by boosting. And so what is boosting? Boosting is it's really a family of methods. So boosting is sort of a generic term. There's lots of ways you can boost. And so what you do is rather than producing, say, a single decision tree, using that, you would say start from some, your training sample produced a decision tree, so like I just said, follow that prescription. And then what you do is you sort of figure out, okay, which events am I actually getting wrong? Because I will not get all the events right. I'll get some events wrong. And what I'm going to do is then I'm going to create a weighted sample from my training sample where I increase or boost the weight of certain events because I got them wrong. Okay. So now what I'll do is I have a new sample, and I'll train an independent decision tree from this new sample. So the splitting will be different because certain events have now been boosted in importance. So when it goes to split, the figure of merit, which includes the weights, will have changed. And so it will produce a new decision tree that is different from the original one. You'll then just go, okay, now combining these two together, what am I still getting wrong, and put in, keep boosting the events. And you can go over and over and over again. And you might do 1,000 of these things. It's usually an input parameter. At the end, you combine them all together to form the boosted decision tree. So the boosted decision tree isn't, say, the last one. It's the full combination of the series, and how you combine them is part of the difference in different algorithms. So different boosting algorithms decide how to change the weights in different ways, generally based on the fact that you misclassify certain events, and then how you combine these together, different algorithms do different things. You can do various ways of weighting their contributions.
Why don't you use the last one? It just logically seems like
Well, it's the best output on this exact data set, right? The thing you're trying to avoid as well is to try and not overtrain. So the fact that you might be getting now all the training sample right doesn't exactly translate. Okay.
Mike, does it follow that the last one, when you multiply emphasize some failing results, does it follow that you still had all the good results first one, or you end up losing some of the good stuff you had in the first one?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that a certain event, that event doesn't necessarily always go up or down in a monotonic way, because it is an independent training. So the fact that some other event has gained in weight might mean that one event will go down in its performance, and it has to be boosted back up. So basically, you get some oscillation of, you know, in each event, maybe go up or down, and but after you get so many of these, it's sort of balanced out for adding more trees.
So the sample is actually the same events in every case. It's just you've altered the weights. You haven't thrown away events. You're not training. You're not the next tree is not being trained on things that necessarily fail.
No, in the standard algorithm, it's just the weight that's done, and how they do the weight though depends on the algorithm. Like out of boost gradient, they change the weight in quite a different ways. The end result though is generally always the performance is the same no matter how you change.
You have a set of cuts that you're applying to your data, as I understand it. So what does it mean to weight, say, a single event more heavily in the face of cuts?
Well, so when it goes, so you're not really cutting, you're splitting. You split the data repeatedly, right? So every data point, it starts, it's still in, but they just end up in different leaves at the end. They might end up in a background leaf or a signal leaf. And where they end up, because of how it splits repeatedly, would depend on the weight. You might split on a different variable or even a different place on the same variable, then the whole tree then will be built in a different way. See what I mean?
but when you measure the success, you don't use the weight. I mean, at the very end, you ask,
you do
how
use
well
the weight.
Are you doing?
You keep using the weights, keep going along.
And the
run.
You use the weights to determine how well you've done.
Or the validation sample.
Well, the validation sample doesn't have weights, right? So the validation sample, you just, the event goes in, and each of these decision trees independently says signal or background.
Right.
And you somehow combine those in some way to determine by the algorithm. Usually the algorithm determines how to weight them based on things like their total misclassification error, so like a weighted average based on that. But they do it in slightly different ways.
So when this happens, it figures out it needs to weight certain types of events in certain ways. And then when you test your validation sample on it, will it still apply those same weights to the validation sample?
The validation sample events don't have weights.
Right.
Right. So they just come in. So the validation for new events, so at this point, you run your actual data. New event comes in, and each of these trees has this sort of structure. Right. So for every event, a new event comes in. This is a split. The event itself follows some path down to a leaf based on all of its properties. That leaf will then either be classified as a signal leaf or a background leaf, which usually most algorithms will give a minus one or a plus one.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, each of these individual trees, then, my new event will just get evaluated and have, like, maybe a plus one here, a minus one here, a plus one. And I will combine all those and get some number between minus one and plus one as a weighted average. Yeah? So there's another option for boosting, which involves doing something called bootstrapping. So bootstrapping, if you're not familiar with it, is statistics. I mean, the term bootstrapping is used in various places, in various fields. In statistics, what it means is you basically simulate the idea of doing repeated observations using only the data you have by sampling with replacement from the original data. What that means is, for example, here's some toy thing I did where I generated data PDF with f of x equals x on 0 to 1. And so I generated, say, 100 events and put in a histogram and it looks like this. Right? Okay, fine. And I can fit that to a line and I get some value for a slope with an uncertainty on the slope, let's say 0.13. Sampling with replacement means, okay, I want to build a new data set out of this data set. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pick at random from my 100 events. I'm going to pick an event at random. And then I'm going to pick another event at random. But I'm not going to require that, say, it's a different, it could be the same event. I'm just going to pick at random an event. And I'll do that until I have picked 100 events. So by doing this, occasionally I'll have some of my events will have multiple copies, and some events will be missing. But I'll have a new data set that's built from the original one. Now, it turns out, then, I can take that data set, I can fit the slope. I can just do this over and over again, right? There's a lot of permutations of original data you can make. And here, I plot the slope that I get by doing this however many times I did, I don't know, like maybe 10,000 or something. And the width of this distribution is 0.15. So it turns out this is actually a really good way of estimating uncertainty. Anytime you actually don't know how to calculate it. Obviously, if you know how to calculate it, you can do it. But it turns out that this actually gives you a really good handle on this uncertainty. If you had 10 people in a room and you measured their height or something, you want to know what the uncertainty is randomly split from 10 people. There might be multiple copies of one person, and that's fine. Generally, people get very confused by this, why this works. And I think a lot of that comes down to the sort of human factor of, you know, if you have however many from lottery that you can win, and all the values are equal probability, right, that they've drawn. So if a value is drawn today, human thinks there's no way that value gets drawn tomorrow, whereas the probability of being drawn tomorrow is the same as it was today. It's no less likely than any other number. Nothing has changed. So taking the values you have, you can actually learn a lot about one third. You can't gain information about the slope itself. So in the original sample here, even though the slope was 1 from the original PDF, turns out I got about 0.85 or something. You know, it's 1 sigma away. And you can see that the mean of this distribution is actually about 0.85. So I don't actually I'll gain information on what the slope is. This is just a way of estimating how important each event is. You can do this in a lot of areas, but if you don't know how to estimate them, sort of units or feet, whatever you're doing, you can seek out around the value chain. So you can do this in decision trees as well. So like what Matt was asking with the original event. So you can imagine you have your training sample, and you just make lots of bootstrap copy data sets. So you just sample with replacement from the original. So there's no new events, but in some of these data sets, you know, certain events have multiple copies and certain events are missing. They're different. You train an individual decision tree on each one, and then you combine them in some way. Usually in this sense, they're all equivalent, so you just do the average value. You can also apply tricks like when you're doing splits. When you do splits, you could each time only consider a random subset of the variables to split on, ranking each of these ones. You might say just remove variable X from this, remove variable Y from that one. They're more independent. That's called the random forest. So the names start to get a little bit different sometimes. That's called random forest. And as an example of needing to know your parameters, so understanding how to use your phone, in most decision trees, in a regular boosting procedure where you do a series, you want them to be fairly stable decision trees. But here, you're combining these. They're purely independent. They're not based on the previous one. So you actually want them to be as independent as possible. You want them to be actually individually less stable. So if you want to use a small number of minimum events per leaf to make each tree actually more unstable, more independent, and so the combination is actually stronger. So it's an analogy. You consider this as like plywood, right? If you're putting together lots of small bits of wood, it's much stronger than if you put a bunch of big bits together like that. But if you don't know that, then you'll get a weak tree. So training, this is not really a problem for decision trees very much, but it depends on how many variables you have. With neural networks, it can really be a problem in a sense that it can take a long time for the training to happen. It might take half a day or something like that. For a neural network, you get a million events, hundreds of variables. So this is sort of like a running joke of if you're a student, you want to be slacking off at CERN and just sort of say, oh yeah, I'm training my neural network. Computer's too busy, I can't. Neural networks are sort of, they're not super complicated in terms of how they work. You start with some inputs, which this is like your variables, maybe X, Y, Z, whatever you have. And the goal is to get some sort of, all these things say however many input variables you have convert into one number, which we call a response. In a neural network, you build a hidden layer of variables, and how many you have is, again, algorithm dependent. Usually, though, there's only one hidden layer. You can have more than one hidden layer, but it generally doesn't give you any good. And so then you somehow then link, people just refer to these as neurons, and then you link them together. By synapses, and so you then somehow say take variable X, and maybe this variable is built as 0.1 of X plus 0.2 of Y or whatever. So there's some way of combining these variables to make each of these variables. There's a mapping to build, and then each of these variables there's in a mapping to build, say, signal or background or response from. So what you do is you start with your input variables, and you have some weight that you get in some way your algorithm decides on in the hidden variables, and then what you do is you figure out if you're classifying events properly or not, and then you backwards propagate the whether you got events wrong, and that updates the weight. So it just sort of goes forward and backwards as it figures out, I'm getting a lot of events wrong, I'll update my weight, and then the equations that you use to update, and it goes over and over again.
What are the weights in this concept?
Well, they're just numbers, so this, for example, this particular hidden variable, it might be 0.1x minus 0.3y, and those are the
weight or combination of different variables that we have.
Yeah. So then, you'll get some events wrong out of your sample. You get some right, some wrong, and then you have algorithms that tell you, okay, based on what I got right and what I got wrong, I should update. And you try again. You see, what do I now have wrong? This is right. Then you try again and again and again and again, and it might out.
Yeah, but equalization between the original data and the other be a combination. Why would you do that?
So how would you, so you want to just start start from how you combine these?
No, but why you cannot go directly from the initial data to the answer? Make some combination and make decisions based on that answer.
That only works if you only had everything being linear, right? That would work if everything was like linear, no non-monotonic correlations, things like that. So you want to be able to build any shape you want, like of a cut, basically, in multiple dimensions. You need to get correlations to be able to design weird things. So by having a hidden layer, you can get more interesting relations. Do you understand? I don't know if any of the algorithms do any more interesting combinations.
I thought that was the advantage of neural networks, is they weren't limited to linear combinations. Sure. Like,
well, you definitely the output you build is highly non-linear.
Yeah.
In terms of your variables. Yeah, I don't know. I have to actually. I never bothered to think about because I don't use them very often. How the mapping exactly would, what exactly you need. Certainly the output you get is that you can create, carve any shape into your multidimensional space if you want. The decision tree obviously is square cut, but individual decision tree is making hyper cubes. Then you combine a Hooke decision tree, it kind of gets fuzzy. But once you can make cubes of any, you know, arbitrarily small, then it's not so important.
That was on.
Is there any limitation for hidden layer? Some rules for creating hidden layer? It should be just linear combination, or you can provide
whatever. Well, I'm not sure exactly what all this is, like what the full spectrum of algorithms. So, I don't really use neural networks very often. The ones I'm aware of, I think, are linear. So comparing these, so the things you really care about are things like how correct are they in classifying. They're basically the same. They're both quite good. Power in a large number of dimensions. Do you have any large number of dimensions means how many variables? We've used them with hundreds of variables. Hundreds of dimensions. Irrelevant input, right? So you can imagine you have 100 things you measure. But not all of them are actually relevant to doing whatever you're trying to select. Turns out that because of how they work, a decision tree is by construction robust against irrelevant inputs because it considers each input variable one at a time on the splitting. So if you have an irrelevant variable, it just will never split on it, with the exception of once you have maybe a few events, the total fluctuation means an irrelevant variable, a relevant implication. So it basically is almost unaffected. You see very little effect of an irrelevant. But a neural network, because of how it builds this hidden layer in the links, and then it keeps updating itself, if it has an irrelevant input and puts itself off on the wrong track, it's really hard for it sometimes to figure out which input is actually irrelevant and how it's mapping them all together. It's not as obvious. But I'll point out that all of the problems I'm pointing here are basically handled by modern software packages in some other way. They have some other algorithm that's like involved in figuring out that there's an irrelevant input. Maybe removing them before the actual neural network trains. This is all done behind your back. This is the same obvious problem with mixed type inputs. So that means you might have continuous and discrete variables.
Right.
You might have some veto that's yes or no. A decision tree, of course, just splits. So it splits discrete values as easily as it splits continuous values. Right? It doesn't care. If you have 0 and 1, then you can pick any value in between. That's a split. You have something continuous from 0 to 1, it picks any value. It doesn't care. Neural networks is obviously if you're mapping variables and you have these weighted sums, it's not good when you have a weighted sum of a combination of discrete and variables. That's actually not so good. But again, the modern algorithms somehow deal with this in some way. Training time, decision trees are actually fairly fast under training, whereas neural networks are very slow. Response time, neural networks are faster on response than decision trees, which is okay. Interpretability, I'd say, an individual decision tree is very easy to interpret. A boosted one is not. It's not, but it's not terrible. Whereas a neural network is a hidden layer. It's basically a black box. A human can't just make it. What is that doing? So usually when you're playing these games, you'll then produce what's called a ROC curve, which stands for Receiver Operating Characteristics. These were originally developed during World War II for radar systems. So what you're plotting is signal efficiency and background rejection. Rejection meaning 1 minus the background. And so what you're looking for is to get something that looks like this. If you read this off as saying that I get a high level of background rejection for a high signal efficiency. And what you don't want is a straight line, because that's worthless. You just throw in the numbers and equally reject signal background. This basically means I'm getting the same efficiency on signal and background, which of course I can do with the random number campaign. You're looking for something that's highly pushed away from the flat line. But generally what you're interested in is actually some figure of merit. And so what you really want to do is look at those as a function of your response and optimize your cut on that, not really on these rock curves, just sort of just for seeing if your thing is operating properly, but you generally don't make decisions on it. So,
good, go back. Yeah, I know something flipped around.
Yeah, I noticed it.
Yeah, okay.
But I was maybe thinking I might get it. Yeah, because I just drew this in Keynote, right? So I think what happened was.
Because you want zero signal efficiency, you have 100% background efficiency.
Yeah, so what happened was originally this did background efficiency.
Okay. Okay.
The label got changed, but the drawing didn't change. Yeah. I noticed it when I put up, like, wait. Did you put the background efficiency?
Go back to your weaker.
Yeah. If you somehow manage to get a tree that works in reverse, then just cut on the negative loop,
or run over it.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. There's, so I've just been showing you, like, roughly in theory how these things work. Really, what you care about is if they actually work. I'll show you a couple of real life examples. This is one from LACD, which is an experiment I'm on. Looking for a very, very rare decay, BS to mu nu. So the standard model prediction for this is a 3 times 10 to the minus 9 branching fraction. It turns out that in proton-proton collisions, at LHCb, this happens, or standard model says this happens 1 out of every 1.6 trillion proton-proton collisions. It's rather rare. It's like finding $2 in the U.S. federal budget. And so what we do in this analysis, we don't actually cut on the decision tree. We train a decision tree, and then we rescale the response to be between 0 and 1, such that the signal efficiency is flat. We just do a cumulative distribution, right? So we expect, if we look at this in bins of decision tree response that are equal size, we expect an equal amount of signal in each bin, sort of like a confidence level. We just do a cumulative distribution. And so what we do here is, rather than cutting, we actually just have all of the data in each of these bins, and we know then what to expect from various backgrounds. And you can see in a low BDT response, we have a lot of background, so you know, thousands of events per bin. And as you go up in BDT cuts, the background plummets. The amount of signal actually stays the same. It's really hard to see on this scale. Background, and then eventually you find that you only really have events. The red bit is where you're looking for this this BS signal. The bit next to it is actually BT. And it turns out that we find them. This was a paper published in the fall. It has three sigma first evidence for this decay. And there's no way we could have looked at this without got at it. So this is actually another thing I didn't talk about. It's actually common in a lot of analyses where you actually take all the variables that you have and you convert them into a decision tree, and then you know various backgrounds. You know actually their shape on the decision tree. They actually fit against the shape of the decision tree response rather than cutting on it. that actually works out really well. So here's a Higgs result from CMS where they actually interestingly published both a cut space and a VDC space. Now the same data. So they actually published the same exact data with cut compared to the decision tree. And so basically here's the decision tree limit versus the cut limit. And if you flip back and forth enough times, roughly, it depends on exactly where you are in the mass range, but it looks like roughly a factor of three. It's about a factor of three improvement in the limit by using a decision tree on the same data. And what's interesting here, I think, is that obviously people have spent about 20 years figuring out what these cuts are. They're just highly optimized in terms of human hours spent on deciding what the cuts would be for this channel. So the fact that the decision tree basically just learns this in something 15 minutes or something like that. It's still able to do better than 20 years of people looking at it.
They didn't have the data, though.
Hmm? Well, they had the data at the end, right? So,
after this, nobody will believe in this. Hmm? After that, nobody will believe in Higgs if you can provide some peak in your system. It's very strange. Why you cut so effective?
I don't understand.
Why is the root of the system?
You make better.
Yes. What do you mean better? I don't understand. You're making very, very complicated cuts, yes? To select Higgs boson here, yes?
Yeah.
As I remember, Higgs boson decay.
It's a WW in this case. They have two leptons and two neutrinos in this particular plot. You can see it labeled on here. So their final thing.
And how many events were there?
How many events do they have?
Yeah.
For
five in your center body. High.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the plot. Thousands of events, I think.
No.
Total events.
10 or 15 events of heat.
But of course I'm not quoting how many
Higgs events. In this mode.
Yeah, I'm not telling you how many Higgs events they have. See how many events they have in this mass spectrum for leptons. Right? Okay. It's probably thousands. But the reason is, are you asking them why does the decision tree do better? Yeah, because it's able to, in some highly multivariate space, to take advantage of the correlations between the variables in a way that is very hard to do in cuts. Right? You have a lot of variables that you measure and detect, and they're correlated, and they're correlated in very complicated ways. And so the machine is able to actually figure out these correlations and take advantage of them. Whereas if you do cuts, it's very hard. You can try and come up with 45 each statement. That you actually realize, these 10 tracking variables are actually correlated for some type of background, some other thing happening.
It looks like you don't understand your machine, your detector, and you just provided some little.
So your cuts are throwing away your understanding of your detector.
What is this?
Not strange at all.
It's too many variables in the initiation for optimal cuts. You're limited, right, in your power. The machine doing it kind of fast.
Right, and if you play this game, for example, with let's say you set up some toy experiment. If you set it up such that you have 100 variables, but none of them are correlated, so you just generate them, so they're all independent, then what you'll find is that you won't get this huge gain.
Okay, but it wasn't published.
Yeah, these are both published.
See, that's preliminary. That's right. It wasn't functioning.
Maybe that exact slide.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe this exact slide isn't. But most of CMS's published limits are from decision trees, not. Although they all of them now on their Twiki page, they have both versions. Like, so for example, as well, you get in Higgs to gamma, you get less of an improvement from decision tree because it's only two cotons. There's not a whole lot of information. Right, so you don't have as many things to look at. You just have two neutral particles. So their expected gain from the Higgs to gamma from using a decision tree is like 20%. Not effective. Because it's a situation where there's not as much room to gain. Right, and most of this is trained on real data. So, like, for example, in the LHCB one, we have access to, say, B to PyPy, which in kinematics is almost exactly the same. We have lots of it. We can calibrate all of this stuff on the actual data. Yeah, there's the improvement that you get. And if you try to work this out, probably of like, you know, how much it actually would cost in money to get that improvement by just running an experiment. And how many more inverse tensor bars you have to get to get back to 3, maybe walk back to 9. Data, that's a lot of money. So just one sort of advertisement slide is that occasionally you come into a situation where you don't think machine learning would work. So for example, here's what will tend to happen. So usually when you're doing this splitting, you're optimizing some figure of merit, and that figure of merit is by default some integrated figure of merit. How much signal divided by how much background, something like that. But oftentimes you're actually not so interested in that. So for example, if you want to do a PWA, what you want is the least amount of background for the most amount of signal, provided the efficiency is flat. Right? You don't want to say, well, in this case I have a dollop plot shown here, where I train a precision tree on this dollop plot, and because of how we threw the background, which this model is based on what you normally see in an experiment, turns out the background, of course, tends to be towards the edges where there's low momentum particles. And we also made the discriminating variables more powerful out here, because that's often the case with particle ID or something, which smaller particles easier to identify. And so, of course, it goes through and it just basically the efficiency at the corners end goes really zero, because that's just what it's maximizing an integrated figure of merit over the whole dollop plane. And that's not what you want. So Justin and I have a teaching algorithm that then fixes. It produces a uniform efficiency in any number of variables that you choose to make it uniform in. And the performance then, of course, if you produce a rock curve, will be slightly worse, because this thing is making the best signal efficiency for total background rejection. But that's not what you want. So it gives you the best value of that, but with the constraint of having uniform efficiency.
Not necessarily mean, too, that the backgrounds are worse than the corners of the outside.
But we threw it. We did two models. One, we threw more background to the corners. One, we threw it flat. So in this situation, if you start with more background there, you probably end up with more background. So another one that was special was triggering. So people didn't think you could do this in a trigger, and I came up with a modification to a boosting algorithm that's designed for triggers. It's been running at LHCB for 2 years. It's taken, it collects pretty much all of the B physics data that we do is actually recorded by this tree running online as a trigger. And it's totally safe and understandable. So occasionally, if you end up in a situation where you don't think this stuff will work, then odds are it's just because the machine doesn't know something you know, but what you know is probably not that hard to teach it. Probably not doing something that is actually, I think, exceptionally not stable would be converted into an algorithm. And so then you just do that. And then, so this, for example, this decision tree learns things like it's quite paranoid about making regions too small, because in online conditions things oscillate around and you don't have perfect alignment. This tree actually knows that, and it doesn't allow itself to create small regions. Or to go in too close to regions where you know you'd be in trouble. So it knows that information, so it learns in that under those constraints. It is the best performance under the constraints that you put out about being a bit paranoid about running. It's actually rather easy to do that in an algorithm, so I don't want to go into details. Machine learning methods are powerful, but you need to make sure that, basically, most people just use the same method over and over again because they know what the parameters mean and they're good with them, and it usually doesn't make much difference in performance which if it's an NLP versus a BDT or something. As long as you know how to use it, that's better. If you're going to cut on a BDT, then you should decide where that is based on some sort of figure of merit which is close to what you actually want to measure. Sort of sounds like it's obvious, but not everyone does that. Most software of TMVA will give you what's called a variable ranking, So in a decision tree, the variable ranking is based on how many times was a given variable used in splits. Obviously, if you have a variable that's used splits, it'll basically never be used to split the data with the exception of fluctuations and small things. Or the really important variable will be used a lot to split the data. And TMB will tell you this, like what fraction of splits of each variable was used for. And it'll give you what's called a ranking. As a physicist, you should basically be able to look at that and say, does that make sense? Does the information I know is the best information? Is that used the most often? And so it's a good way to check to make sure things are actually making sense. Occasionally, you'll see something that you don't think makes sense, and it turns out you're wrong. There's one of the things that's true in physics, it's hard to predict what backgrounds look like. So whenever you find something that doesn't make sense, usually what it means is there's some type of background you didn't anticipate, and it has some weird correlation between variables to this background that you didn't understand, and then a machine found it because it's falling away with splitting it. It finds it. TMBA is very easy to use. You can just basically type a string and pick which classifier you want. You can train like 20 different ones and pair them all together. But in the end, you know, your training data is never going to be perfect, so you really need to find ways to validate the performance and determine efficiency on real data if you can and really try to make sure you understand that. But we actually have situations in LETV where we actually understand that the performance or boost specific can be better than the cut space. So I can see why. Basically because it's combining all the information and we have a way of validating all the information combined rather than having to do each of the ones individually.
So with the real data then, you just, I mean the real data contains background in it, so.
Yeah, so you have to have situations, you have to look for situations where you have like a proxy channel or something that's quite clean.
Yeah.
That you know is similar or reweight or something. So every situation is different. But yeah, it's always, this is just generally true, I think. What people generally do now is that I think there's sort of like a fixed amount of time that they're willing to spend on an analysis. And so what I've seen, what you see at CERN now is that people basically spend zero time developing selections because they just let the machine do it, and they spend all the time validating the efficiency and making sure that the systematics are all played out. I think it's actually probably a better use of time to constantly validate and make sure that everything's actually working.
Is there a way to validate
Yeah, so this is how we do things with looking for, well, you just feel like you validate any cut. Right? You look for some situation where you know the answer or you can validate in some way by seeing how it performs. Sometimes you can use Monte Carlo, sometimes you use combinations of two, depends on what you trust and what you don't trust. But we're generally getting super tiny systematic uncertainty to be, we can validate them in real data.
Is that like how you for your LHCB product, like DS and C minus, like you would like have some kind of systematic error in the DS is three.
Yeah.
And that would be based on some kind of proxy channel or something or
yeah, bits of it are based on various things. So in that one, I mean you can work out how it works on a signal by just applying it to the beat to pi pi. And you know the pi and lifetime, that we definitely get right in Monte Carlo. So you can work out the cadence flight is mu on time. So from various places at other channels, you know the decay in flight, you know the probability of having a different idea of the muon for final. You can work that out with the data very easily from other channels. And if the kinematics are identical, basically, to pi pi, you know the signal performance really well, how it works. So that's one of the main things. But then there's also other channels where you can validate as well. So there's lots of things that will work similar to the data you're interested in that case. I think there's just basically always a way to do it. The team makes sure you come up with a way to do it. Yeah, so my summary is enjoy the training, I guess. But, you know, validate. That's just always true, right? You always need to validate whatever it is you're doing. But, you know, our experience at CERN, and that's all the experiments that do it, has been that we get a huge boost in performance, much lower background levels than we would have with CUT. And we can understand and validate these very well. So they're definitely something that is used in almost every time. Any other questions?
You kind of mentioned algorithms resolve for radar and for what?
No, the rock curve. Like where that whole concept of rock curve comes from is from the rock.
Well, what about where is the algorithm? Yeah.
Well, I mean, machine learning has been an area of research for quite a while. Boosting is rather new. So decision trees have been around since at least the 70s, I think, or 80s. But then boosting was something that's more like probably last 20 years, 10 years. And so decision trees on their own are actually, they're fairly called weak classifiers. They're not particularly powerful. But then when people realized they could do this boosting trick, started seeing that they think we're actually outperforming neural networks by quite a lot. So one of the reasons that the performance is so similar is the same reason why your phones work so similar, that basically everyone just copies off the competition, right? So, you know, you can boost the decision tree, but you could, of course, boost the neural network. There's nothing somehow special about the decision tree itself. The idea of boosting can be applied to any thing that classifies events. And it turns out that lots of other tricks that people have come up with, they sort of just mostly apply across the board. Market forces have kept them all
being honest. I guess there's a very small element of that. I think in a previous talk, I think you mentioned that there was like some decision experiment that like first started to apply this kind of stuff to the
The book decision tree first application is Mises.
Yeah.
Particle idea Mises.
So do you know, like, are there any other experiments besides the ones at CERN and with Mises that you see? Because like a real popular thing.
They were being used. I'm trying to think if the B factories. I don't know if the B factories were used. B factories were using other things at times, like more simple classifiers, like linear discriminants, like predecessors, things like Fisher wrote in the 30s that assume everything from your decoder. I don't know. How many other experiments out there are using and certainly neural networks have been used in low-level theory for a lot of experiments. So you can take some, but you can take a piece of hardware because testing just take a mountain of data. And all you want to know is like what does some type of particle look like when it hits this. You can really learn that. Really well from that, and then just put that in, and all that neural network does is feed a hit in some detector and identifies it as like an electron. Right. So that's been done a long time ago. I don't know how many, but certainly not a small fraction of what people are part of the world is actually getting quite promising.
Roger, question?
You mentioned CMBA a few times, but I think that's going to be the next talk. My question was going to be, in outline, what is it?
So CMBA, so TRC is because it's a root class. MBA stands for multivariate analysis. So basically, people went and they made a bunch of classes, but basically a package for roots called CMBA. It has implementations of decision trees, all the different types, of different types of boosting. They have different types of neural networks. They have support vector machines, k-nearest neighbor, all these various things. And what you do is just provide the data in some string, basically, and say, I want to use EDTG, gradient decision tree, or I want to use MLP, multi-layer perception neural network. And it just does your string, and it tells the feedback in. And because it's so easy, you can also just tell it, like, train these 15 types, and it produces me a plot at the end that shows all the rock curves superimposed. So people do this all the time. So you'll see at meetings, people are like, well, we ran 20 different types of classifiers, and here's all the rock curves. And of course, they all like form a big band. You know, they basically all perform almost the same. And occasionally, there's an outlier, and that just means they probably picked a bad parameter somewhere for it. I think if they weren't similar, then people they would just drop off the fix. They wouldn't be in the market if they weren't able to sell the outlier.
Okay. Very much, Mike.
Do you have any other questions that you know? Yeah.
So Justin has been applying these boost decision trees to a lot of our analysis channels for GlueX that we use in the PAC proposal. or it's the main one that we submitted. So he's going to be showing us how to use it.
Yeah, so Mike told you how the stuff works, and I'm going to show you the code of how to do it. So some of all exercises actually stepping through the process of implementing one of these decision trees in PMDA. So before we started, for the exercises, just a couple things. One is just go to the session directory and do the SPN update. Just make sure you get the pages I checked in early this morning. And then for the people that got the virtual machines and the flash drive, we couldn't fit one of the data files we need for these exercises on the in the virtual machine image. We have an extra root file on the flash drive that you can just drag from your desktop onto the desktop of the virtual machine, and it will put it on the virtual machine image. If you have your flash drive, you can grab this 3.5. BCGen sample and because we're going to need that in a specific directory when we get to the exercise. So you need to do that now or you can do it as I'm talking if you want. Okay. So the Reinhardt was asking, PMDA is a toolkit for multigrade analysis. The idea is to have a common interface for all these different algorithms that Mike was talking about. And so the idea is that you can have the same setup for inputting all your data for just a one-time price. So you have your data in a tree format, you sort of input the data into this PMDA package, and then you can train all the multigrade analyses on that at one time. And logistics is it's a standard package in root, so anytime you just check out the usual free source and build it, you get PMDA for free. So there's no new software to download, build, anything like that. It just works out of the box with your general root install. So they have a nice web page, and also at that web page, a user guide, which is super helpful. I recommend you download it. And most of what I'll be talking about is sort of based on examples in there, and there's lots of information in there. Okay, so let's start with just a generic example of what how you would actually build one of these decision trees and do an analysis. So these lines of code are everything you need to build a decision tree, train it, test it, validate it with a validation sample, and then get a lot of diagnostic plots about how it performs. So it's really, in terms of end-user code you have to write, is really tiny. So it takes care of all this stuff sort of behind the scenes for you. So this is, in this session, session 6B, I took the tutorial from PMDA and ripped out sort of all the stuff you don't really care about. So it has implementations for all the different algorithms, and so I just implemented this one ghost decision tree algorithm for just to show you, it fits on one page. So the things you start with, your general setup, you need to initialize what they call this factory. So you initialize the class and give it some output file to write your diagnostic plots to, and then the next thing you need is to give it the variables that you want it to use. So you have some subset of variables from your event that you want to use to help you classify your signal or background. And so these can be coming from a tree, a T-tree, in a root file, or they can be ASCII format if you want to, but you know, the root file is much simpler. And so you just define these variables as what they're labeled in the T-tree. And so you can have variables which are just single variables that come from the T-tree, or you can form variables which are combinations of some subset of variables. So simple things, basically anything you can do in T-tree draw, you can put here. So you add your variables, you have some data that you want to do your training on, you grab a root file,
you need, in principle, you need a signal and a background sample, so you can either store those in Qtrees in the same file, and in this factory you just add the tree for the signal and the tree for the background. In this case, they come from the same file. You can grab them from different files, whatever you want. And so this is sort of the general setup for everything that you need for all the different algorithms. And the sort of two lines of code you need to actually implement the, it's only one line of code, the book method is where you actually implement one of these algorithms. And so if you wanted to do all the algorithms supported by CMBA, you just have a line book method for each one of the algorithms you want. And I'll talk in some detail about what the choices are for the decision trees. So this is your sort of your setup. You initialize things, set up your algorithms, and then at the end, you train, test, and evaluate. And that's it. That's the rest for you. So I'll talk a little bit about the general setup and sort of line by line. I said a little bit about this, but so you need to know what variables to use for classification. So you give these variables. Anything you can do with Qtree draw is fine. So you can add variables, use, one of the things we do is this confidence level for PID things. So you take chi squared and number of degrees of freedom, you can compute probability with CMath, and that all works inside here. Things you can't do, things like, combining T-learning vectors for the three, the three pions you construct to get the, three pion invariant mass. So that's, a little bit of disadvantage, but we'll talk about how you can get around that. So you need these event samples, then you have to so you provide these input event samples where you know one is signal and you know one is background. But like Mike said, you want to do sort of, you want to have two subsets of those samples. So you want to have, you want to split the data into a training sample and a test sample. So you want to train on one subset of your events, and then after you develop your algorithm or you teach the machine how to do the separation, you evaluate it on a separate test sample. And so the way you do that is you can actually specify what fraction or the number of events that you want to use for the training, for the signal, and for the background in these two trees. So if you wanted to use, the default is just put zero here, and that means you split them in half. So you put in 2,000 signal events and 10,000 background events that uses 1,000 signal events and 5,000 background events to do the training, and it uses the other half to do the testing. Okay.
So it's all just one input file for each one, then it's splitting within that input file.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And if you had, if you wanted to use the first half of the events, the last half of the events, you can use splitting. There's a split mode where you can just randomly sample them, or you can, divide it however you want. Okay, so this is how you actually book one of these BEC classifiers. So you have this factory where you use a book method. So you call the type of method you want. In this case, it's a decision tree, and a name for that. And then there's all these parameters for the things you want to use, sort of the available things you can vary in the way you actually build this decision tree. So Mike kind of talked about some of these, but I'll just go through and tell you sort of from these commands what you're actually doing. So you have this variable for the number of trees, which is just you have this here. Mike has these rows of different trees where you train each one, build each decision tree separately with new weights. So you just define what number of those you want. Usually 100, a few hundred is enough, and then at some point there's no return for adding more additional trees. Also, when you're actually building a single decision tree, so you need some minimum number of events that you want to keep a leaf at the end. So if I split the data here and I split it again, I might get down here where I only have 100 events in this leaf, and so it's not really worth me trying to split that again if I'm going to be sensitive to the fluctuations of that small number of events in a leaf down here. So you can specify how far you want to go down in your tree when you're building it.
Number of trees. So is that whole thing one tree?
This is one tree.
So when you say like 100 trees.
Mm-hmm.
Those conditions are for change?
They're changed because you've reweighted the event.
Oh, so each tree, each different tree would have a different weight?
Yes. So Mike has, on his slide, he trained the first decision tree with unit weight.
Right.
The second one, you boosted the weight of the events which you misclassified the first time. That's tree number two. Then you see which ones you misclassified for that second event. You boost the weight for those, you go down to number three, and et cetera, until you get to 100 or whatever you want.
So that weighting is kind of done automatically with the algorithm.
Yes. Yeah. And it's done differently for different boosting types, which we can talk about later. Right. So these are sort of defining how you build these trees. You can define the maximum depth of your tree, so how many of these splits you actually want to do. This boosting type, which there's different types like Atta boost or gradient boost or epsilon boost. And that's just the way, like you're saying, you do this weighting. You also need to define how you actually want to do this, how you decide which variable and where to cut gives you the best separation, or the best separation between signal and background when you split here. So this is called the separation type. The common one is the Gini index, which is purity times 1 minus purity, so the peak where you split the data basically in half between signal and background. The number of the in cuts variable, so for each of the distributions, you have to scan, for each variable, you scan some range of cuts that you want to use to actually do this splitting. And if you have, this is essentially the granularity with which you scan that variable. So if you had some fine structure inside of one of the variables you wanted to be sensitive to, you need a large number of in cuts to be able to sort of make a finer bin cut on a particular variable. And then the last piece is what we call pruning, which is if you just let these number of events and the maximum depth be large, the tree will just build itself until it runs out of events, a few events at the end. And one thing you can do is actually to let the tree build itself to its full sort of amount of leaves, and then go back and with some algorithm decide which ones of those are insignificant, and then prune those away. And so you can sort of pick your poison, whether you want to limit how much you build the tree first, or whether you want to build it until you have insignificant leaves, and then try to prune it back some amount. So there's different options here. To be sort of safe, you can just keep these the minimum number of events large, the maximum depth small, and then just don't do any pruning, so you have sort of small trees, but that may not be the optimal case for all methods.
How many, at some point it must depend too on how many events you're
right. Selected
somewhere here.
That's just whatever you input. So you can decide how many events you want to train on.
Right, but is it wiser to train on a small number of events or a large number of events? Is there some quickness improvement if you have a larger sample?
Well, it's sort of, you can have, at some point you add more events, you don't really gain much because you don't have any fluctuation if you're sort of training small samples down here. But if you had, the larger number of events you have, the farther you can probably build down your tree with still having significant heat. But the training time increases with the number of events you put in, so at some point there's limited gain in adding lots and lots of events. So, for example, when I show the example we're using for this N3Pi, I use 50,000 thrown signal events and 2 million background events. Which gets reduced quite a bit by some of the different selections and efficiencies, but that's sort of to give you a scale of the number of events you're talking about.
And then how long does it take to train
that?
A minute.
For a decision tree, if you want to use like a neural network, it's 30 minutes or something.
Even then, that's not horrible.
No, it's not terrible. Any other questions?
Then it sounds like you set the maximum distance.
Uh-huh.
Is the small
Yeah, so if the maximum depth is 3, you only allow yourself to, you know, include a few variables in the way you build the tree. So your single decision tree won't be all that powerful. But if you have lots of trees, then you sort of get all these extra, you know, the ones you misclassify because you only use some set of the variables in this tree, you may use a different set of variables in the next tree because you've boosted the weights of the ones that you misclassified.
Right, but shouldn't be kind of permitted in number of variables in your data set?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I think the...
So, if you have, let's say, 50 variables, it's not a good idea to set the maximum depth at 3. It should be kind of comparable with the number of variables. Or it's not necessary because you have many trees.
I think because you have many trees, you can sort of play with the maximum depth and the number of trees you use to sort of cover yourself. If you choose the low maximum depth, you can actually gain that back.
So there is no actually some kind of default rule. If you have some variables, you need therefore.
Not that I'm aware of.
You can always just not make this required. But if I think in TMJ, you put minus one, a negative number.
Yeah.
And cut, put minus one, then just go there.
But you're not talking about n sets, you're talking about the
max depth.
Okay. So you might talk about this next slide even, but just real quick. The first level, let's say it thinks the kinematic fit confidence level gives you the best signal to background separation. So the first level of the tree, it cuts there. And then when it goes to the next depth level, does it then say, okay, I think, you know, the PID confidence level on my K plus is the next best?
Yeah.
So then it cuts there. So it goes down to a depth of 3. So then it reweights, and then in this new tree, maybe no longer the kinematic fit confidence level is the number 1.
Yeah.
The new one might be something else entirely.
Mm-hmm. So we can, when we train this and we look at the output plots, you can actually look at each individual tree like this and see which ones it chose to do the cut. So we'll try to get there before lunch.
All right.
So
on that slide, it seems like you have the variable cut xj on the left side and then xj on the right side also. So does that mean that at like the same level of cut, like you always cut on the same variable?
No. No, these are not, these don't have to be the same variable.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, I stole this from their manual, so. So then you have, you set up your options that you want. Now you want to train, test, and evaluate. So you want to train all these methods. So like we're saying, this builds this, what they call a forest of trees. So there's 100 possible decision trees. With weights for each one of them, here I'm calling them alpha, and so this is essentially the fraction of events, or related to the fraction of events that you wrongly classify. So you get this for each tree, and then the way you build this classifier, which is your single number, which you'll use as, possibly get used as a cut for to select your signal background samples, is a linear combination of the weights for each tree. And this H is either a plus or minus for whether the event you know, went down and was in a background leaf or a signal leaf. Okay.
Wait, it's a logarithmic function.
It's just the way they define this for one of these, this ADA boost, one of those boosting procedures. So I'm just giving you one example of how you combine this misclassification error into a weight that you can weight these trees. So there's lots of different ways to do this. This isn't the only way to weight the response of each of the trees. Okay? So this VG classifier, you have an event that goes through all of the, you know, selections and goes through one leaf node for each tree. You get a yes or no, and then you have some weight for that tree, and you combine all those, and that gives you this response, VG response value down here. And so this is a typical output from TMVA. This is their sort of toy example of just some simple Gaussian functions which are separated by a small displacement for their example. And so you have four histograms here. So you have a signal sample in blue. This is still histogram, which is the test sample, and then the data points are in for the training sample. And so you do this train method, you get one histogram for how they fall on the BDT classifier, and then you test those on a separate sample of events. And if those fall along the same, you know, they have the same shape and the right position, then that's telling you that your test sample that you use, which is independent, is responding the same way as your training sample, and so if things are all making sense. So the test method is what actually runs the second half of the data through your classifier that you built here. And then the evaluate method function just spits out a lot of these diagnostic histograms. And here's this rock curve that Mike showed before, so now it's really the background rejection on the y-axis and signal efficiency here. You can see, you know, a lot of background rejection, you have very low efficiency. And if you go up your efficiency and efficiency, your background rejection is going down. Right. So on to our example, which is this gamma pi to n3 pi. To be able to, you know, so far we've looked at mostly just this signal sample. So a lot of the plots you've been making are just for if we generate a signal, which is just this reaction. But we know we have lots of other reactions that are going to be produced in production reaction Kulak. So just to give you a sense of scale for things, this is, I guess I didn't put the link here, but this is one of the Kulak documents about sort of rough cross-sections. So this gamma p to 3 pi n, the cross-section from data is roughly 3.2 microbarns, and the full cross-section is 124 microbarns. So we're talking about a signal fraction starting out of something like 2.5%. So in order to try to, you know, get at this, how well can we separate this signal channel from the background, we need samples of what Mark talked about yesterday was this BGGen or Pythia, which just produces this full hadron cross-section. And we have these signal samples that Matt talked about from AmpTools, which is the real signal we're looking for. And these were generated with this relative signal fraction between here and the total cross-section. So the training we'll be doing is with 2 million background events and 50,000 signal events before any of the reconstruction starts.
What's the difference between the data column and the Pythia estimate column?
So the data column is what has actually been measured at similar experiments previously. And then the Pythia estimate is what our version of the speed in Pythia estimates the cross-section is for this process.
So those are both at 9 GeV?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or this one's close to 9 GeV, if it's not right at 9 GeV.
Yeah.
I'm using this number, but if you look in BGGen for this signal topology, you'll see that it's like a factor of 2 or so smaller than what we've measured before. So that's the other point, is that the BGGen sample does contain this signal topology of N3 pi, and so we'll want to exclude those from our training of the BGGen. We don't want to include signal N3 pi events from the BGGen sample in the background that we give to GMBA, because those are really signal type events. Right, so if we have sort of this simple example where we have just these limited variables which you can read straight from the T-tree, it's very simple. You just grab the variables that are right in the T-tree as a variable. But it might be that you have some more complicated variable that you want to include. So, like I said before, you can form simple things like you have a chi-squared for the timing PID information and a degree of freedom. You can do this with T-tree draw, and you can include that in CMBA. But more complicated variables, like if you wanted to sum up Lorentz vectors and look at their invariant mass, you can include directly from GVA. So what I did was use this T selector that Paul was talking about before, where you're making these plots of invariant mass and things. And you can use a T selector to build sort of pre-process these analysis trees that you've been working with Paul. And you can write out what they call a friend tree. So a tree that has the same number of entries which match exactly to this analysis T tree. And you can fill this friend T-tree with new variables that you compute in the T-selector. So take a look at, let's take a look at the code that actually does that. So it's in the session B.
Luckily, yes.
So we'll need that. I talked at the beginning about this.
Just the same with this file.
Root file that's on the jump drive. You'll need that in this directory, Luex data session 6B. On the image.
Yeah, did everybody get it from the stick, or does anybody need an extra stick to grab that file?
Did you pass one to the TV?
Yeah, I did, but
what's that?
Can you pass one of the sticks through the TV for us?
No, we still.
Can you pass a stick through the TV for us?
Yeah. Well, if you downloaded the virtual machine from the web, it already has the file in the right place.
Okay.
So the issue was it didn't fit fit in the image on the jump track. So you're remotely and you downloaded it, you're safe.
Okay.
Your version's fine.
Thank you.
Right. So. If we go to session 6B, the key selector that we're using is called selector tree in 3Py. And so, open that. So there's a README file there which asks you to do, the first thing is just to link this data directory, which points to where the root files are stored, and you just do that in your session directory where you were. So now you should have a link to the data directory that we'll be reading the root files from. The first step, and then the second step, you can actually just run this macro, which is pre-train in 3Py. So you can just start that, and it'll take a little while to process the signal and background samples. But basically what it's doing is, so you're sort of familiar with this, the T-selector options where you have this begin function that's called at the start of your the processing. And then in the processor, in the process function, you can build these new variables that you might want, which aren't included directly in the T-tree. So one of them that I'm using, one of the variables that I decided to add was, if you look at these unused charged particle hypotheses that Paul was looking at before, or that Paul was talking about before, you can loop over those and look for this particle hypothesis that has the highest proton figure of merit, PID figure of merit for being a proton. And so the reason you might want to do that is if you have gamma p goes to proton and two pions, and you misID the proton as a pion, you should have an extra unused particle hypothesis which has a high proton figure of merit. And so if that's the case, then you can use this sort of act as a veto on this particle combination, which has a proton which is mis-ID'd as a pion. So the way you do that is similar to how you were sort of filling histograms in this T-selector before, where you can just have a loop over these, the number of unused hypotheses, and then just calculate this PID figure of merit, which comes from the chi-square and the number of degrees of freedom that are stored as variables in the T-tree.
Right. You remember that the unused particles are just stored in an array. So, like the four vectors, it's just an array. For each index of the array is a new hypothesis.
Right.
So, the loop is.
Yeah. Right. So you're looking at the other unused charge track hypotheses that are included there. The other variable that you need to make, which is not in the T-tree itself, is we need a definition of which particle combinations are the real signals that we're looking for, the real signal topology. So to do that, you need to know that the reconstructed track is actually matched to the ground track that you're looking for.
Because remember, there's combinatoric background. Even in this real signal data, you might have a wrong combination. So you're trying to select the true signal combinations out of the true signal data.
Right, yes. You have the combinatoric background in your signal T-tree, and when you train, you want to only use the real combinations which match to the thrown particles and not the combinatoric background in your signal for the training. Okay. So we need to match each of the charge tracks to their momentum or to the thrown track, and then we also have this I find the true signal is so each of these charged particle pi plus match ID, you look at the thrown PID for that particular particle and make sure that it matches to the PDG particle ID number. So you don't have to worry about all the details of this, but essentially we want a variable we call true signal, which is only events which are the actual N3 pi, the reconstructed tracks we have are matched to the N3 pi thrown signal event.
But you should think of that probably as not combinatorial background, but just reconstructed. Because
yes, right.
all the things you're selecting, a true combinatoric background, all the things you're using to select your signal will also select the combinatoric background. The only way it's different is you just permute particles around. You're not selecting on any invariant masses or anything like that.
Yeah. That's true for the signal, but we also have the BGGen sample, which we want to get rid of the combinatoric background there as well. So.
Right, but the BGGen sample also is only different in invariant masses, which you weren't selected on. So it's just broken events, right, is what you're trying to...
Well, it's reconstructed events.
Well, for example, because physically you have one positively charged particle, it makes the pi plus hypothesis, the k plus hypothesis, and the proton hypothesis. So you could have two combinations for that event, one of them where the pi plus, the true one, survived, and one where the k plus, never mind, sorry.
Okay. You want to match the where you have the true PID for the thrown track matches to the PID of the reconstructed track.
Sorry.
Okay, so what it does...
Can you have a situation where the ID numbers are correctly matching, but it's still not the right combination?
Yeah.
You just have them in the right particle category, but not the momenta aren't right or something.
Well, but
the matching algorithm uses the momentum to try to pair them up.
Matching algorithm.
It's not clear from what he said. He said it compares the numbers.
Well, the thrown PID array, what it does is it tells you it has an index for each of the reconstructed tracks. And the value of this array is the PID of the thrown track, which is best matched to that reconstructed track. So you look at all the reconstructed tracks and try to match them to thrown tracks from from the Monte Carlo record. And the ones that match, you assign the lab a 5 plus that's reconstructed, I think something is a 5 plus that's reconstructed, and I find a thrown 5 plus that's right here next to it, then I say that that is a match, and then the PID of the thrown PID for this reconstructed track is 211, which is the PDGID for this.
And that comparison has already been done for you, and it's in the tree. He's just looking at the result of that comparison.
Yeah.
The matching itself has already been done, safe as a tree.
Yeah.
We're matching the momentum matches.
Right.
And the PID information matches.
Oh, it's just the kinematics. And you don't want to make PID constraints. You just want to know, is this the same reconstruction track that comes from this thrown track? Okay. So, anyway, I'm trying to get too hung up on the details here, but basically you want to write out these extra variables to a friend tree, and that's what you do in the second step of the README file, which is this pre-train and pre-py. And so I just ran that, and you should have seen this processing the number of combinations, and so it should have run over a VGGen sample and a signal sample. So in your directory, you should have this in3py friends tree, which now contains these new variables you formed in your key selector, and the same thing for a VGGen sample and a signal sample. And so once you have that, you can go to step 3 of the tutorial, which is to actually run TMVA to train on this sample.
Which is that? Fail?
The previous one. I mean,
that's two.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we'll probably just try to run this training, and we can look at the GUI, and then we can come back after lunch and do the rest, because we're already at 12:20 here. So once you have these friends trees in your directory, you can run this train n3py TMVA, which is actually training on these signal and background samples, like I showed in the talk earlier. So that'll take a little while to run. I'm piping all of the output to a log file, because it stores some extra diagnostic information, which we'll look at later, about how the variables are ranked and which ones are actually giving you the best or contributing the most to the performance. You get this little scroll bar if TMVA is working properly, telling you how well it's doing in its training. And at the end, it'll say it's done. And then we can... So are people able to get the friend tree okay? And this pre-training step of building a friend tree is really only necessary if you have some variable that's not in the tree itself. If you have things, if all the variables you want are in the tree, then you can just go straight to training your digital tree. And in principle, you could build custom actions, like Paul was talking about earlier, which put these variables in the tree as you're building the tree itself. So this is sort of an afterburner. If you built all the trees and then found out, oh, I want to add this variable, you can go back and do it without, you know, writing all your trees again.
I haven't figured out a thread-safe way of doing that, though. I mean, I know how, but I don't want to do it.
But in principle, it's a good class to edit.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you got a little message that your training stopped here, then you can go to, so as you saw, that took like a minute to do this training of this decision tree. You can go to step 4, which uses this TMVA GUI.c macro. After you finish this training, you'll have a new root file, which is this n3py train TMVA. and that contains all these diagnostic plots that the CMBA spits out automatically. And this GUI essentially just reads that in and puts them in a nice way to look at all of them. So if you have that, you can just run GUI, and it'll spit up something like this, where there's lots of different options. I think we have a couple minutes. We can take a look at some of those just to see what they do, and then we can play with it over lunch and maybe when we come back. So the first thing that's nice is it just gives you all your input variables that you handed to CMBA to start with. So, for example, the things I included in the tree are things like the PID timing, so using the time of flight system and the time of flight measured by the VCAL, a figure of merit for that particle ID information. So, not showing here, but the blue in all these cases are for the signal, and the red are for the background. And you can see for the timing figure of merit for the charge 5 plus, you have the big spike at 0 for the background, and then the blue for the signal that has this sort of more flat distribution with not as much there. So this is a variable which you could put a cut here at 1%, but you would be losing some of your signal, whereas here you sort of include it in your training, and then you can use that information but not have to put hard cut on that value. So there's other things like the energy loss, the PID information, the figure of merit. So we have those for all three charged pions. Let's see what else. There's the kinematic fit confidence level. So again, you can put a cut here at 1% if you wanted to. But, you know, if you include this in your fit, it's just one piece of information that goes into how you classify the event as signal or background. One of the other variables that's pretty useful in this case turns out to be the missing neutron transverse momentum. So in the previous studies, that's the plot down here at the bottom, in a previous study of this channel, you can look at this, and it turns out that a lot of the background is from proton 5 plus by minus events where you just get the missing mass wrong. But if that's the case, then your transverse momentum is basically, it has to be zero because you conserve it with all the charged particles. But if you have the missing neutron, it has to have some kick relative to the pion, so you get this peak at 500 MeV for the transverse momentum of the neutron, whereas a lot of the background is peak around zero. So this just gives you an idea. You can look at all your variables very simply here for signal and background on one plot. And when we look at the rankings later, that's useful to see. So back to the GUI, there's other things like you can make scatter plots or correlations of all your variables. I won't click on it here because it takes quite a bit of time to actually do this from, build all the correlations between the variables. But that's useful. So this classifier output distributions is the thing that if you've seen any of my talks on this BDT stuff, you've seen lots of these plots. So you have your BDT response variable where you have background and red for training and testing in the two different types of the red histogram, and then signal in blue. And you can see that with this choice of variables and input parameters, you get reasonable shapes comparing between the testing and the training samples, so it looks like everything's behaving sort of as they expect here. What else are you supposed to look at? You can make plots of these rock curves. So this is the background rejection and signal efficiency. So from this plot, you can't really see what the purity is because you don't have any normalization for how much background you have left at the end after you make a cut. But it gives you some, this is a good way to judge performance between different multivariate methods if you have them. I guess obviously one more thing and then we can go have lunch and come back later. If you click on this decision tree plot down here, it opens up a little another box where you can click on that. And you can actually look at all the individual decision trees if you want to. So this one starts with, looks like, hard to read here, but the kinematic fit confidence level is the first variable that was split on. You make it split here, this signal over signal plus background is just the purity of your sample at that point in the tree. And so you see you split over here, you have a much higher purity at 0.24, and then you choose this, it's called missing neutron X4, which is really just the primary vertex radius. They don't label things super well here, but in any case. And then, again, if you go to the other side, you can split here, you have lower purity, but you can choose another variable. In this case, it was again cutting on the kinematics of figure merit, but in the other direction.
Way lower. It's 1% instead of 9%.
Oh, right, yeah.
First one's 9%. It separated 9% at first, and then it separated 1% in the
second
tree.
Yeah. Right, and so you sort of build this thing for, you know, and when you get down to some small number of entries, you don't split again. And so you can kind of just, you can see, you know, actually look at each decision tree physically and scan through them by going to, you know, skip to decision tree 10 or 25 or whatever if you want. And you can just look at how they split the data. So that sort of gives you some more intuitive sense of what variables are actually being used in each of the decision trees and forth. Okay, so I guess I'll stop there for questions, and then we can come back and play around with some more after lunch. That's all right.
All right, I think we're good. How are we doing on the schedule? All right, so you want to come back at 1:30? So stay on schedule. It's an hour still for lunch. 1:30. All right.
I think that
Okay. Can we look in that folder real quick? That's LS data. You do LS data to make sure it's there.
I put,
you got the final.
Yeah, I put there the.
Oh, no,
the,
no, you didn't.
No,
the file's not there. The file is BGGen in the file name. And that file is missing. That's probably why it crashed for you. Yeah, so let me show you my folder.
Thank you. Please stand by.